Pennsylvania Avenue.
Adrian Fontes, I want to thank you for being with us. Secretary of State for Arizona, elected in 2022. Previously, he was the Maricopa County recorder who oversaw the 2020 elections. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. To look more at President Trump's calls to nationalize the elections and other attacks on the voting system, we're joined by David Becker, executive director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. Significantly, he's a former Department of Justice attorney in the voting division. Thanks so much for being with us, David. I want to start with this picture of Tulsi Gabbard in Fulton County, which was ground zero for the 2020 election conspiracy theory, standing there on the phone. The news is that she used her cell phone for President Trump to speak on speakerphone with these FBI agents that raided the election county office and took 700 boxes of voter data and rolls away. What is the significance of the director of national intelligence and the president of the United States speaking with these FBI agents? How unusual is it?
It's incredibly unusual for any kind of search warrant. Usually when a search warrant is executed, it's executed by professionals who are experts in collecting evidence and establishing chain of custody. Remember, the whole purpose of a search warrant is to collect evidence for use in a future legal proceeding, probably a criminal prosecution. And to introduce that evidence, you're going to have to be able to account for that evidence every step of the way. But here you've got the Director of National Intelligence, who has no statutory authority to be involved in a domestic election investigation, and certainly not to be present during the execution of a search warrant, not only in the local county election warehouse, but apparently on the phone with the president of the United States at the time. And as disturbing as this is, I can almost assure you, it's much more disturbing to the very, very few experienced litigators who are still at the Department of Justice. Because if the Department of Justice ever sought to introduce this evidence at some point, this is a defense counsel's dream. They're going to call, I would expect, call DNI Gabbard to the stand to establish exactly what she was doing in that building, what evidence she had access to, whether she altered the chain of custody in any way, and perhaps even call President Trump since he was on the phone during that. This is going to make that evidence really difficult to introduce at any future proceeding, which, of course, is a problem ultimately for the Department of Justice.
And can you talk about exactly, do you understand where these voter rolls went?
So my understanding is it's predominantly ballots and other documents. If it was voter rolls, it might have been printouts or something like that. I mean, those likely were old. We don't know exactly where they went. We don't know under what conditions they have been stored. We don't know what they're doing with them. And it's important also to note that the 2020 election, and Secretary Fontes made this point as well, is the most scrutinized election in world history. There has never been more litigation, more scrutiny, more review, more recounts, more audits of an election than any election in history, in world history. And those ballots in Georgia in particular, paper ballots throughout the entire state, which were recounted and recounted again, counted three times, three different ways, once entirely by hand under the observation of both parties. So we know what happened. That happened well over 5 years ago, which raises another issue because there's a federal statute of limitations about the alleged crimes that were committed that would have expired after 5 years. It's unusual that a magistrate might have signed off on this warrant. We'll have to see what happens. But my understanding is also that Fulton County has now gone to the federal district court in Atlanta to challenge this warrant. And we'll see what happens over the course of the next several days.
You are a former official at the Justice Department. This is semi-related, I think. The Wall Street Journal reported that there is a whistleblower complaint against Tulsi Gabbard so highly classified that it's said to be locked in a safe. It hasn't been shared with Congress. It was apparently filed in May. Can this have anything to do with why she's doing what she's doing?
I try to stay away from speculation on this. I don't have any specific knowledge about that whistleblower complaint. I mean, I think that, you know, she has asserted to lawmakers who challenged her on her appearance that she has authority to be there, that she's part of an overall investigation into interference in the 2020 election. It may be true. She has some authority to investigate foreign interference. Again, the statute of limitations has run. But regardless of what that complaint says, there is no valid reason for a political appointee of that level to be at any execution of a search warrant ever. You can only imagine what would have happened if the director of national intelligence under President Biden had been physically present at Mar-a-Lago during the execution of the search warrant when they seized documents there, and how that would have been used by his then defense counsel, Todd Blanche, who now sits as the deputy attorney general, to challenge the evidence in that case.
Very quickly, several of the most prominent pro-Trump election deniers are back in the news this week. You have Trump advisor Roger Stone posting a message on X reading, "Honored to chat with our incredibly effective Vice President J.D. Vance." Meanwhile, Justice Department official Ed Martin posted a photo alongside Trump's former lawyer Sidney Powell. In October 2023, she pleaded guilty in Georgia to attempting to overturn the 2020 election results. Ed Martin helped organize the Stop the Steal protests that aimed to overturn the 2020 election. And you've got, what, the former head of the founder of Overstock, Patrick, what's his name, I think, Byrne, invited back to the White House. All of them deeply involved with the conspiracy theory going to the White House on December 18th, 2020.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've got an ecosystem of grift that has grown out of the lies about the 2020 election. There are people who are targeting the sincerely disappointed supporters of President Trump. And we all understand what it means to be disappointed in an election, even if we disagree with people and how they voted. But they're being targeted by grifters to receive money over the course of this 5+ years. And it is easy to go on social media and friendly media, and even the president does this, and make false claims about the election. But as Secretary Fontes pointed out, time and time again, when they have been given the opportunity to present evidence in court over more than 5 years, time and time again, they have been begged to present evidence to defend themselves in court. And time again, in dozens of cases, including before Trump-appointed judges, in defamation cases where they could have presented the truth as a defense, Rudy Giuliani, Carrie Lake both conceded liability and defamation and accepted hundreds of millions of dollars of liability. Fox News settled the case for almost $800 million before presenting a shred of evidence. And Mike Lindell, who was sued, stood on the courthouse steps spreading lies about the election and then went inside the courthouse and said nothing, presented nothing under oath. So when you hear these lies from these grifters who continue to try to profit off of the lies about the 2020 election, ask them to tell it to a judge, because those judges have stood firm and required them to present proof. And the simple fact is the 2020 election wasn't only not a crime, it was one of the great successes of American history, not because a particular candidate won or not, but because somehow the election officials, Republicans and Democrats from the state and local level, managed an election with the highest turnout in American history during a global pandemic. And their work has withstood more scrutiny than any election in world history, and it has stood up to that scrutiny every time.
David Becker, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Center for Election Innovation and Research, former Department of Justice attorney in the Voting Decision Division. Next up, the Bulletin of Concerned Scientists have put the hands of the clock closest to midnight than they've ever been when it comes to nuclear war. Stay with us.
Sola voy con mi pena. Sola va mi condena. Correr es mi destino para burlar la ley. Perdida en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen clandestino por no llevar papel. Pa' una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Tijuana y Bagdad. Soy una raya
Downs performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now's 25th anniversary celebration during the pandemic. And now we're moving into our 30th anniversary. I hope people come out to the historic Riverside Church on February 23rd, 7 o'clock, for an amazing celebration of 30 years of this daily global grassroots news hour. You can go to democracynow.org for tickets. Among those who will be there will be Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Nobel Prize-winning journalist Maria Ressa. Will also be joined by Michael Stipe, the singer and songwriter. Wynton Marsalis will be performing, as well as Hooray for the Riff Raff, and so much more. That's February 23rd. Go to democracynow.org while tickets are still there. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Arms control groups are warning the world is moving closer to nuclear war as the U.S. continues to threaten to attack Iran and a major U.S.-Russia nuclear treaty known as New START expires Thursday. Last week, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists set the doomsday clock to 85 seconds to midnight, the closest the clock's ever been to midnight in its history, due to rising threats from nuclear weapons, artificial intelligence, and the climate crisis. This is Don Hulse of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
The doomsday clock is now at 85 seconds to midnight, the closest it has been in the history of the clock. Last year, we warned that the world was perilously close to catastrophe and that countries needed to change course towards international cooperation and action on the most critical existential risks. Unfortunately, the opposite has happened. Rather than heed this warning, major countries became even more aggressive, adversarial, and nationalistic.
We're joined now by Dr. Ira Helfand, steering committee member of Back from the Brink, a national coalition which has organized people in cities and towns across the United States to call for the end of nuclear weapons. Dr. Helfand is a longtime member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which received the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize. He's also the immediate past president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which awarded the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. And Dr. Helfand is co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Talk about the dangers the world faces today and what this New START treaty is all about that expires tomorrow. Dr. Helfand.
Thanks for having me on, Amy. You know, we are in a very, very dangerous moment. Things have been getting bad for some time. Tensions between the United States and Russia have been getting worse. Tensions between the United States and China have been getting worse. Tensions on the Korean Peninsula have been getting worse. India and Pakistan actually fought a war for a few days last year. It's an unprecedented situation. In the last year, five of the nine countries which have nuclear arsenals have been engaged in warfare. Russia, the United States, Israel, India, and Pakistan. And China's been making very explicit threats that they want to take over Taiwan, which would probably also involve military action. And any one of these conflicts has the potential to escalate to nuclear war. The warning that we received last week from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists really needs to be a wake-up call. We cannot afford to live in denial about this danger any longer. At one point in our history, back in the 1980s, when the danger was also very great, we all got it. You know, millions of people were marching in the streets because everybody understood how dangerous the situation was. Well, it's even more dangerous today. And the big difference is that people aren't paying attention to it. On Thursday, tomorrow, the New START Treaty is going to expire. This is the last agreement between the United States and Russia that puts limits on our nuclear arsenals. And with the expiration of this treaty, the path is now open for a very dangerous, very destabilizing arms race. We already have 1,500 nuclear warheads deployed. The Russians have the same number. The best science we have says that if these two arsenals are used in a war between the United States and Russia, 100 million people here in the United States, 100 million people in Russia, maybe another 100 million people in Europe will die in the first half hour. And the climate disruption that will result from that war will cause global famine that over the next 2 years will kill 6 billion people, excuse me, three quarters of the human race. That same study that came up with those numbers also looked at what would happen if India and Pakistan went to war and found that a war between these two relatively small nuclear powers involving just 250 nuclear warheads could kill 100 million people directly and also lead to a global famine, not quite as severe as we'd see in a conflict between the United States and Russia, but bad enough to kill 2 billion people, a quarter of the human race, in 2 years. So that's the armament we have already. And with the expiration of New START, there's talk of expanding the arsenal further. Here in the United States, there are powerful voices saying it's not enough to have 1,500 nuclear warheads. We need to have as many as the Russians and Chinese put together. Well, if the United States increases its arsenal to a size equal to the Russians and the Chinese together, the Russians are going to say they need to have an arsenal as big as the U.S. arsenal. And it's just going to cause a spiral, as we saw in the 1980s when we got to the insane level of 70,000 nuclear warheads in the world. Today, it's 12,000, enough to destroy the world many, many, many times over. There is no rational reason for any country to build a single additional nuclear warhead. But with the expiration of New START, that's probably exactly what's going to happen. And that arms race is going to be dangerous, not just because of the additional numbers of weapons that are created, but also because this is a destabilizing process. It creates increased tension and leads to a greater possibility of conflict.
The New START Treaty was signed by Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, Russia. Last September, Putin proposed each side should agree informally to stick to the warhead limits for another year. Why hasn't Trump accepted this? And ultimately, because I know you have to go, what will bring down, bring us off the brink?
I don't know why Trump hasn't accepted this. He said initially that he thought this was a good idea, but then didn't follow through on it at all. And his more recent comments have been, if it expires, no big deal. It is a big deal. It's a really terrible thing if this treaty is allowed to expire tomorrow and nothing is put in place to replace it. What we need to do at this point is to build a movement in this country that will force our leaders to take the kind of action that Gorbachev and Reagan took in the 1980s, fundamentally changing the trajectory that we're on. We have a defense policy that's based on the dangerous myth that nuclear weapons make us safe. They don't. They make us strong, but strength and safety are not the same thing. These weapons are the greatest threat to our safety, and we need to move to a world that eliminates them. We have to understand that if we don't do that, if we allow these weapons to continue to exist, it is not a question of if we have a nuclear war. It's just a question of when. We are told that there's something special about nuclear weapons. They have this magic power. It's embodied in the deterrence theory, that no one would ever use these weapons because they're so powerful. The fact is that we know of at least six occasions during the course of the nuclear weapons era when either Moscow or Washington actually began the process of launching the nuclear arsenal, only to discover at the last minute that the alarm they were responding to was a false alarm. We have not survived this far because deterrence works. We haven't survived this far because our leaders were wise all the time, because they knew what they were doing, because they had perfect information and perfect technology. We survived because, according to former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. And luck doesn't last forever. So we need a new foreign policy, a new security policy that takes this into account, that starts from the premise that our security demands that we seek a world free of nuclear weapons. It's possible we won't be able to achieve that, but we have to try, because if we don't, we know what's going to happen, and it's going to be terrible. Now, what we've done here in the United States is to build a campaign back from the brink that's designed to mobilize communities around the country around this demand that the United States begin negotiations now with the 8 other countries that have nuclear weapons for a verifiable, enforceable agreement to eliminate their arsenals according to an agreed-upon timetable. We also ask the United States to take a number of unilateral steps that it can do with safely, which will lower the danger of nuclear war and demonstrate our good faith in entering into these negotiations.
Dr. Ira,
we don't ask the United States to disarm unilaterally, but to provide leadership for universal disarmament.
Dr. Ira Helfand, I want to thank you for being with us. Steering committee member of Back from the Brink National Coalition, which has organized people in cities and towns across the United States to call for the end of nuclear weapons. Speaking to us from Abu Dhabi, from the United Arab Emirates. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at that meeting between President Trump and Colombian President Gustavo Petro at the White House on Tuesday. Stay with us. Peruano, hondureño, mexicana,
marihuana, ilegal. Si no peleamos por los niños, ¿qué será de nosotros?
Again, Lila Downs performing Manu Chao's Clandestino for Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary 5 years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Colombian President Gustavo Petro sat down with President Trump in a closed-door meeting that lasted approximately 2 hours at the White House Tuesday, the first face-to-face encounter between the two leaders following months of tension and heated exchanges over the Trump administration's military strikes on civilian boats in the Caribbean and the Pacific Ocean. Their talks also came a month after the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife in early January. Petro's urge for Maduro's release and return to Venezuela. After the White House meeting, Petro shared a photo on social media with a note apparently handwritten by Trump that said, quote, "Gustavo, a great honor. I love Colombia," unquote, with a photograph of the two leaders shaking hands and smiling. Trump took on a drastically different tone after he previously insulted Petro, falsely accusing him of being a drug trafficker, threatening Colombia with U.S. military action. Petro spoke after the meeting on Tuesday.
I told him that between free people, one cannot act under blackmail. Do this or else this happens. No, we do not act under blackmail. And I think the photos and the atmosphere of the meeting show a meeting between equals who think differently. Yes, with different powers, obviously, but capable of finding common paths. That's it. Nothing personal. He did not speak to me about his businesses, nor I about mine, which I do not have.
And this is President Trump in the Oval Office responding to questions about his meeting with Petro yesterday.
Mr. President, how was your meeting with Gustavo Petro earlier today? And did you come to any agreement on counter-narcotic efforts?
Yeah, we did. We worked on it, and we got along very well. He and I weren't exactly the best of friends, but I wasn't insulted because I never met him. I didn't know him at all. And we got along very well, and we are. We're working on that. We're working on some other things, too, including sanctions. And we had a very good meeting.
Colombian President Petro traveled to Washington, D.C. on a special visa after the Trump administration revoked his previous one in September when Petro joined a pro-Palestine rally outside the United Nations headquarters in New York and urged U.S. soldiers to disobey Trump. The Trump administration also issued sanctions against Petro and his family in October. For more, we go to Bogota, Colombia, where we're joined by the Colombian Senator Clara López Obregón. She is a presidential candidate in the upcoming elections in Colombia scheduled for May. She was acting mayor of Bogota in 2011 and served as the Minister of Labor after that. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Senator. If you can start off by talking about what you understand took place yesterday in the Oval Office. It was a closed-door meeting. You had President Trump viciously attacking Petro. You had Petro demanding the release and return of the Venezuelan President Maduro before this meeting. And then it was all smiles afterwards. We almost thought it was a replay of President Trump meeting with the New York City mayor, Zoran Mamdani.
Well, what I see is a very important repositioning of coercion and diplomacy in the Latin American context. I think President Petro was able to reframe precisely with that quote that you just passed regarding our common commitment to liberty, to freedom, from which he could establish a common language to establish very controversial issues which definitely separate us, like climate, like migration, like Venezuela, like sanctions. So I think that in a very asymmetrical position, President Petro was able to elevate through moral principles, through a force of character also, and an ethical stance, a more equal interchange with President Trump in his Oval Office, which is obviously the center of power, not only of the United States, but of the world.
What do you think, Senator Clara López Obregón, is the path forward on issues like drug trafficking, energy trade, military intervention, the U.S. strikes in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and continuing to detain the Venezuelan president, not far from where we are right now, in a Brooklyn detention center, both Maduro and his wife?
Yes, this is a re-edition of the Monroe Doctrine, but not as an ideological cover for intervention in our countries, but as an instrument for coercion, depending on how good the alignment is of each country with the United States interests. Our response has to be getting together. Latin America, unfortunately, has been unable to structure a meaningful and a permanent instruments of collective action. So each country has to negotiate on its own from a position of weakness. And I think that what we have to construct in view of all of these new coercive actions and violence, international violence through military intervention and sanctions, that the United States has recovered as an exercise of control. The only alternative that we have is what we call the geopolitics of the week, getting together, coordinating our diplomatic actions, and using international law in a strategic way. I think that we have to recover the moral narrative of international law with a connection with Europe, with the United States, with all the progressive sectors of society everywhere. Because what is happening in Latin America is not just Latin America's problem, as what is happening in Gaza is not just the Middle Eastern problem. They are all connected, and it has to do with the United States losing hegemony internationally with the rise of China, of India, of Russia. And I think that the only way forward has to be to resist, but also to act and create resilience through a common interest that we can discover, like energy and like migration.
Senator Clara López Obregón, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do this interview in Spanish and post online at democracynow.org/ES. Yes, Colombian Senator Clara López Obregón speaking to us from Bogota. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. I'll be in Santa Barbara this weekend at the International Film Festival. Hope to see people there Friday and Saturday.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Ducks Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities and wildlife. Supporting vital ecosystems which contribute to water quality and quantity, soil health, support agriculture and economy, mitigate severe weather events, and provide opportunities for recreational access to nature. Together, we are unlimited. Learn more about programs and partnerships at ducks.ca.